This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. 100 years ago, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution granted women the right to vote. It was a watershed moment for women's rights, but many American women were not able to access that right for many more decades. White suffragists literally pushed their black counterparts to the back of the movement. And that dynamic is one of many that shaped the fight for voting rights right here in North Carolina. Angela Thorpe is the director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission, and she's with me now to talk more about the story of suffrage in our state. Angela, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Anita. Thank you for having me.
So you've been working on this She Changed the World initiative and exhibit that really looks at this story of suffrage in North Carolina.
Yes.
Tell me a bit about that story.
So North Carolina women's suffrage really began as early as the 1890s. That's when you see some of the first suffrage clubs and calls for suffrage popping up in the state. And then you see some early suffrage leaders really beginning to spread clubs and sort of the message across the state and lobby the General Assembly in the early 1900s.
And North Carolina doesn't really look so good when it comes to the actual question of ratification. There are some really interesting archival materials that you all have collected, and one of them is a telegram. Tell me about this telegram.
So this telegram is really a call to ratify the 19th Amendment. So in North Carolina, it was one of the last states kind of on the table to actually ratify the 19th Amendment. So you need 36 states to ratify this, and North Carolina and Tennessee were kind of those last two states. And Woodrow Wilson, President of the United States, encourages the governor of North Carolina, hey, tell your General Assemblyman to ratify this amendment. And that is taking place, that correspondence is taking place through a number of items, including telegrams.
And then there was a telegram that was sent from the North Carolina legislature to their colleagues in Tennessee, asking them to not approve the amendment. So there was a point where it just needed one more state, and it was between Tennessee and North Carolina. And North Carolina said, hey, we're not going to do this yet, Tennessee. Y'all shouldn't do it either, but Tennessee went ahead and they became the 36th state. Is that right?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. So again, with Tennessee ratifying the 19th Amendment, voting rights for women were granted to all. But North Carolina still declined to ratify that. And in fact, it was not until 1971, really in a ceremonial act, that the state of North Carolina actually ratified the 19th Amendment.
So talk about some of the dynamics on both sides of the suffrage issue in North Carolina, and especially the role of race.
Yes. So as I mentioned, suffrage sort of conversations were happening as early as the 1890s, but there are women, both black and white, who are ingrained in this conversation. One of North Carolina's earliest suffrages was a woman named Gertrude Wheel. She is the daughter of German immigrants. She is a Jewish woman, and she is really calling for suffrage as a means for social equality for women, particularly white middle-class women across the state of North Carolina. You've got to understand, she leaves the state, she receives a college degree, and she comes back and is really sort of gunning for more for white middle-class women. And so she goes on to establish suffrage clubs across the state that are really critical in lobbying the North Carolina General Assembly to take a stand or to take action around suffrage in the state. But she's got some counterparts that kind of take it a step further. Some of us are familiar with a woman named Lillian Exum Clement. She's out of Asheville, North Carolina. She actually goes on to establish the National Women's Party that, again, takes it a step further. She goes on to lobby the federal government around suffrage. And so these are some of the white middle class women who are really critical in bringing suffrage to the fore in North Carolina. And I should mention that Clement was actually the first woman elected to the North Carolina General Assembly in 1920. So she began serving in 1921.
And as we know, the feminist movement was definitely not intersectional at this time. Many white feminists did not see black women's right to vote as equal to their own, and really pushed these women to the outskirts of the movement and were using arguments that were extremely racist in talking about their colleagues who are black women and other women of color fighting for the right to vote. So who are some of the black women that were kind of pushing back on these activists like Gertrude Wheel? And what was their role in this whole story?
Right. So one of the most prominent suffragists from the state of North Carolina that was a black woman is actually Dr. Charlotte Hawkins Brown. She's pretty well known for her activism around educational advocacy for black youth. She founded the Palmer Memorial Institute in Sedalia, North Carolina, which is right outside of Greensboro. But she was also active in a number of women's clubs on the national and on the North Carolina level. In fact, she was a leader in the North Carolina Association of Colored Women's Clubs. And in that, she is calling for suffrage, right? One of her main calls was that this needs to be an interracial movement. Dr. Charlotte Hawkins Brown really worked to kind of reach across the aisle and get white suffragists to understand the potential power of the black women's vote. So again, Dr. Brown is working across the aisle. Another pretty well-known suffragist that was a North Carolina native is Dr. Anna Julia Hayward Cooper. She's one of the earliest black women to receive a PhD. She's born enslaved in Raleigh, North Carolina in the late 19th century. And her call for suffrage was really understanding suffrage as an opportunity for economic and social mobility within black community. She argues that suffrage is not necessarily a black issue or a white issue. It's a women's issue. And she's saying, hey, we're trying to achieve the same thing, right? We want equality for our communities. We want our children to be healthy. We want our communities to be healthy and viable. And so again, can we work together to make this a women's issue, not necessarily a race issue?
I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now, Catherine Mellon Sharon. She's an associate professor of history at North Carolina State University, and her research focuses on African-American and Southern women's history and really looking at this question of who got access to the right to vote and who didn't with the ratification of the 19th Amendment. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anita.
So pick up this story, kind of where we're leaving off with Angela. The amendment passes, but many women still do not have access to that right to vote for decades longer. Tell us about what happened between 1920 and then 1965.
Well, following the passage of the 19th Amendment, you actually did have African-American women show up to register to vote, and you had white male registrars kind of flummoxed because they didn't know what to do. But they would go away and come back the next day and find out they had to pay a poll tax or there was some new kind of rule that kept them from voting because the idea was to keep all African Americans disfranchised. Gradually over time, particularly after World War II, there's a renewed push for voting rights for African Americans, particularly after the Supreme Court's decision in Smith v. Allwright in 1944, which outlawed the all-white Democratic primary. So you get this movement starting in urban areas, and then we have the rise of the Civil Rights Movement, which, as you know, voting rights is particularly important and a key factor in that. And women were very involved in voter education and voter registration during the Civil Rights Movement.
And there were many prominent activists with North Carolina connections who really understood this fundamental issue that just the right to vote on paper doesn't really mean anything if people don't have the education, the literacy, the community knowledge around how to access that vote and what it means. So you have women like Ella Baker, for example, who's such a great example of bringing all of these together. Tell me a little bit more about Ella Baker.
Well, so Ella Baker, of course, was a native of North Carolina, Littleton, Halifax County, and she did a lot of effective work in the movement. I would say one of the most important things she did was work with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party in Mississippi, organizing a challenge to African-American disfranchisement, but also working with women leaders in Mississippi, like Fannie Lou Hamer and Victoria Gray Adams, to get people involved in this party, to get people registered, to get people the education process that led to their involvement.
So we have this moment in 1965, the passage of the Civil Rights Act. 20-ish years before that, in 1941, Native women got the right to vote. So by, you know, the early 1970s, in theory, more American women had were able to access that right than in the past. But we know up until today, that's not exactly true. And especially the kind of what many people call the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, which happened back in 2014, really changed the game for these federal protections on the right to vote. So take me into this a little bit of this contemporary history and how we've gotten from 1965 to where we are now.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about what happened after 1965 briefly. After 1965 with the Voting Rights Act, which outlaws literacy tests and things that kept people from voting, black women begin to run for office. So here I'm thinking of someone like Eva Clayton from North Carolina, who first runs for office in 1968. Now, did she think she was going to win? Not necessarily, but the whole point of the campaign was to increase voter registration among African Americans, but also to go through that educative process, bring people on board so that you understand beyond going to the election, going to the polls on election day, you have to be willing to learn how to use the vote to benefit your community. So Eva Clayton first runs for Congress in 1968, but it's not until 1992 that she's actually elected, becoming one of the first African Americans from North Carolina to serve in the U.S. Congress since 1901. And so after she runs for office, that opens up other opportunities, and she gets involved in community development, which is another way that women work with existing networks to pull people in to this educative process. And so I always try to stress in talking about voting rights, it's not just what happens on election day. It's about how you learn to use the power of the ballot to improve your community.
Yeah. Well, these questions of the power of the ballot and looking at women like Eva Clayton and these prominent figures in North Carolina, how do you, I mean, as we're looking at this, I guess what I brought up earlier, the 2013 Shelby County versus Holder decision and how that has disenfranchised a lot of folks. How do you see that, Angela, from your perspective when you look at this long history?
Sure. From my perspective, I think of two things, right? I think of legacy, one, and then two, the importance of remembering. Part of why I chose to go into this field, right, of history and public history is to educate folks around what has happened in the past so that we don't continue to repeat our mistakes over and over. And I think we're seeing a historical moment where history is manifesting itself in different ways right now. And to me, that's absolutely terrifying. And so to Kat's point around education, I think we have an opportunity here to continue that legacy of organizing to provide education and to get people to the polls. And that's that point about legacy I want to make. We have seen that women, especially Black women, have had a long history of organizing, again, in the hopes of creating social and economic opportunities for their communities. From the early 20th century, Alpha Suffrage Club, the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs, to historically Black sororities and fraternities. And we continue to see organizations made up of Black women band together to do some of this work. And so, again, we have an opportunity to continue a legacy, to turn around some laws and some strategies that have been enforced to disenfranchise African Americans today.
And you bring up a really good point that the way that we tell the story of social movements really matters mm-hmm. in how people feel included, whether they feel motivated to act. And I know that's a lot of your work, Kat, is looking at the story that has been told about suffrage in North Carolina and how we can tell a different story that is more inclusive. And you look also at rural North Carolina and how it has not just been in these urban pockets that these movements have taken place. Can you take us a little bit into that?
Well, in terms of how movements happen or how victories happen, the types of organizing you see during the civil rights movement and since and before, it's all about preparation so that when the opportunity comes, you can seize it. All right. The federal government is behind African-American voting rights in 1965. What do you do with that? And so that's a really important part of seizing the opportunity. And what I think we need to do in retelling these stories and this history is so often it makes it sound like, oh, you know, Dr. King gave a speech and everyone risked their lives to go register to vote. And we don't understand the behind the scenes organizing that's required before people will take that risk. And often that's a location of women's leadership and women's work in the community. And so we need to understand this longer history and how long it takes to produce substantive change. And we also need to ask, whose interests do these oversimplified stories serve, right?
And when you look at movements and you look at identities like feminism, I mean, today, feminism is going through its own revolution of thinking about how to be more inclusive of people with various gender identities, various sexual orientations, and kind of yet another example of looking at who has held a microphone, who has held the power for so long, and how can we better distribute that power. So as you go through North Carolina and you take this exhibit around, how are people responding to these questions that are being raised and looking at this history?
Right. So people are responding well, but I also think that this is leaving space for people to ask questions, which I think is a good thing, right? This exhibit does a really wonderful job in kind of opening up some gaps that folks aren't familiar with. And I think people can take the questions that they have around those gaps and use it to inform their current work, whether it be around organizing, whether it be around understanding who has access to the polls, who doesn't have access to the polls. And so, again, I think that this exhibit is coming at a really wonderful opportunity in making people think differently about what voting and access to the polls means to their communities today.
Yeah. Kat, we only have about 30 seconds left, but as we're remembering the ratification of the 19th Amendment, kind of looking at where we are today, what is the biggest, I guess, concern that you still have about this question of voting rights and voting access?
I'm very concerned with voter suppression and the different forms that has taken since 2013, 2014. I think I heard Stacey Abrams describe it last week as, you know, it looks like administrative error now. You have long lines. You have people whose machinery doesn't work. You lose the data entered into the machinery, right? And these are just other forms, more sophisticated forms of voter suppression. So because history teaches us that attacks on voting rights are pretty much relentless for some people, right? We also have to be relentless in our fighting that as well.
And acknowledge that history continues to repeat itself, right, as you mentioned, Angela. Thank you so much to both of you. Angela Thorpe is the director of the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission, part of the North Carolina Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. And Catherine Mellon Sharon is an associate professor of history at NC State. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You can find the tour dates for the Women's Suffrage Exhibit and Absolute Moral Certainty at our website, stateofthings.org.